concludes medical professionals who worked with the CIA and Pentagon, quote, designed and participated in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment and torture of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and at secret prisons overseas. The two-year study cites doctors for breaching patient confidentiality and advising interrogators on how to exploit prisoners' fears and crush their will to resist. The task force consists of 19 experts from the fields of military, health, law, and human rights. They're calling for a full investigation of the medical profession's role in U.S. torture and an overhaul to ensure doctors involved in interrogations follow ethical standards. The hedge fund giant SAC Capital has agreed to plead guilty to securities fraud and pay a record $1.2 billion fine. Under the agreement, SAC admits to a massive insider trading scheme that reaped hundreds of millions of dollars in profit for the film and its billionaire owner, Stephen Cohen, over more than a decade. Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, unveiled the settlement.
The KABU Foundation. The KABU Foundation. Licensee of non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7, Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yemen. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KABU's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Close Guantanamo, a public forum featuring the past president of Veterans for Peace, Elliot Adams, plus Portland's Guantanamo Solidarity Vigilers. Close Guantanamo is co-sponsored by VFP Chapter 72 and the Economic Justice Action and Peace Action Groups of the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Adams will discuss different messages about why we will be better off when Guantanamo is closed from various perspectives: Christian, Muslim, Jewish, those concerned about national security, and the fiscally minded. Close Guantanamo will be at the Elliott Chapel, First Unitarian Church of Portland, on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue on November 7th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. More information about this event can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kabu.fm. Up next is the KABU Evening News. And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, dedicated to helping working adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including an MBA in healthcare management with evening, weekend, and online options. Listeners can learn more at the information session on Thursday, November 7th at 6:30 p.m. Details at merrillhurst.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the father of a victim of Portland police brutality dies.
Shell Oil Company prepares to drill in the Arctic despite critics.
Protesters demonstrate in downtown Portland in support of the international hacking network Anonymous.
Good evening, this is the KABU Evening News for...
Thank you.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 5th, 2013. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Nat Parker. Portland lost a tireless advocate for human rights and against police brutality this week. The father of the late Keaton Otis, who was killed by a Portland police officer in 2010, passed away on October 29th due to a stroke. Fred Nelson Bryant is a Portland native who has spent the last 3 years trying to get justice for the 2010 murder of his son, Keaton Otis, who was shot by a Portland police officer. Joanne Hardesty, a police accountability advocate in Portland, spoke to the life and work of Fred Bryant as he fought for justice against police brutality with KBOO's Sequoia Wright.
How close were you to Mr. Fred Bryant?
Fred Bryant and I worked extremely closely together, especially since the death of his son, Keaton Otis. I met him right after Keaton Otis was killed by Portland police on May 12, 2010. And he and I met or talked every single week, trying to work on making sure that Portland police would be held accountable for killing Keaton Otis because he looked like he might be a gang member. And in fact, I called Keaton Otis Al Trayvon Martin case, certainly not our only one. And the biggest difference was that he was killed by an armed gang of gang enforcement officers who stopped him merely because he didn't fit the car he was driving. He was driving his mother's car. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the death of Keaton Otis contributes significantly to the death of Fred Bryant because he worked so tirelessly meeting with elected officials, traveling to New York to speak about police violence in local communities, speaking anywhere I asked him to speak.
Talk a little bit about what Fred Bryant was seeking from City Council on police accountability.
Yes, anytime there was a city council presentation on police accountability, whether we were talking about changes to the independent police review, changes to whether or not family members can appeal to the community review committee of the independent police review, what Fred Bryant found was that the process that set up that we the public believe is supposed to make us hold and hold police accountable when they act inappropriately. What Fred found was that doors were closed to him constantly. The IPR refused to request that the police do another investigation. The police review board refused to allow Fred to appeal their findings. And so every step of the way, he found the systems that are supposed to protect us failed him every step of the way. And so my work with him was about us convening. I have a committee that's working on doing a community grand jury it was supposed to give Fred some relief, that at least if the community heard all the evidence that the police had, that the police said of what happened, the community would come to the same conclusion that I and Fred Bryant's family came to, that what the police said was absolutely impossible. It couldn't have happened that way. And so there are community members that have been working on doing this community grand jury. I know myself and my husband have been going through the police testimony page by page so that we could make sure that we continued to help him with this battle. Now that he's gone, his daughter, Alicia Bryant, I hope will step in to his shoes and continue this battle. Because we can't, the community cannot afford to let Fred down.
Talk a bit about how successful Fred Bryant was with the City Council on police accountability.
Well, he was successful because he was able to connect with community members who never had any interaction with the police. He was able to personalize his experience so that people understood, but for the grace that could be me or my family. His success with the city council, especially when Chief Reese was speaking, was that he would not allow the city council to not address the issue that he was still looking for justice. So he would testify at city council. He'd testify at community meetings. Fred Bryant would go anywhere where people would want to hear what happened to his son and how they could get involved to help. I think he was just a phenomenal man because he was just full of energy, because it took a toll on him. It took a real personal, physical toll on him to tell that story over and over and over again. But he never said no. He would always go, whether it was to schools, whether it was to community-based organizations. He would always go and he would tell that story because he wanted to make sure that somebody else's son didn't have that experience.
Okay, Joanne, and based on the work that you are continuing in terms of police brutality and now continuing on with what Fred Bryant has been working on, as you say, tirelessly, what's next? What do you think is going to happen next? What do you think the community needs to do?
Well, of course, this funeral is going to be this Saturday, November 9th at 11 a.m. at Highland Church. Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. After that, we go back to work. We go back to work on making sure that the community grand jury happens, that we keep Keaton Otis and Fred Bryant's name in front of the police and in front of the city council. As I continue my work around police accountability and really reforming the institutionalized nature of that organization, Fred Bryant and Keaton Otis are always in my forethought. And so my work will continue on with Fred, using Fred's name as well, because he's still with me, and he will be helping me continue this work.
I have been speaking with Joanne Hardesty for Voices from the Edge, and she is also very close with the father of slain Keaton Otis, Fred Bryant. Thank you so much, Ms. Joanne Hardesty.
You are so welcome. It's my pleasure to be able to talk about the phenomenal work that Fred Bryant did and the work we have to continue to do. Thank you.
And this is Sequoyna for KBOO Evening News.
Fred Bryant's memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, November 9th, at Highland Christian Center in Portland.
Today is the 5th of November, a day known to the British as Guy Fawkes Day, named after a man who tried to blow up Parliament in 1605 and was later executed as a traitor. In the U.S., supporters of the international hacker group Anonymous organized a million mask march in different U.S. cities in defense of freedom and justice, and in a challenge to what organizers see as a growing tendency towards fascism in the U.S. government. About 100 Portlanders participated in a march from Waterfront Park to the Right to Dream 2 homeless rest area and across the Burnside Bridge today. KBOO reporters were there and bring us the sounds of the event.
You've got to know that what we do here today, what happens here, does not start and it does not end here. You bring this back to your homes, to your friends, to your families, your co-workers, your jobs, your communities, and then that's it. So everybody, have a happy November 5th.
For those who don't know who Jeremy Hammond is, he is a political activist who has been around for a while. He hacked into Stratford, released a lot of government documents, exposing very similar to Snowden about like government spying. Part of that, the stay has been over a year. Some of that was solitary confinement. He's facing 10 years for doing something which he had no financial gain. Basically the equivalent of doing a sit-in. So on November 15th, he gets sentenced. So go to the website, freejeremy.net. Talk about it, raise awareness. If he does get 10 years, he's going to need a lot of support. So
our people have been bred to believe that this is a dog-eat-dog world where no one will ever watch your back and no one will give you a hand up when you fall. This is not the truth. Our minds have been caged by the illusion brought upon us by the fear propagated by the corporate media. So we cower at the thought of another being caring for us unconditionally. The definition of humanity is the quality or state of being humane. Humane being defined as marked by compassion, sympathy, or consideration for humans or animals. Most parents taught their children that everyone was created equal and that everybody should be treated fairly. So what went wrong? Who taught you otherwise? My brothers, my sisters, I beg of you to reach down to the deepest part of your soul and find that perpetually bright shine and turn upon the darkness that has been breeding in our city streets for far too long.
Those were the sounds of a protest held today in Portland as part of a National Day of Action against tyranny in the spirit of Guy Fawkes. Among the participants in today's march was a homeless family who spoke with KABU about their situation. They said they received help only from Right to Dream 2 and not from the government.
We've been on the housing list for 8 months.
8 months.
Eight months. We got a newborn baby.
People are getting ahead of us.
Yeah, there's families
out here. Yeah. Now our government's solving problems. We've been on the waiting list for 8 months.
Wow.
We have called every single homeless shelter and family shelter and women's shelter in the city.
From here to Vancouver.
And Beaverton and Hillsborough and Gresham.
Everywhere.
We've gone on all the lists for 8 months.
Wow. And we're still living in a warming shelter.
Constantly checking back on them, and we're living in a warming shelter with our newborn baby. I want that to stop.
And they can stop throwing money at the problem and actually do something about it.
And actually do something and actually help somebody.
What do you think is the way that actually do something about it?
Actually help people. Actually get people housing and actually help them.
Yeah. Have buildings open up for families who are
open up apartment buildings. You know, have the city buy specific apartment buildings to house families.
And do you think the Right to Dream 2 should be supported by government funds for what they're doing?
Yes,
very much
absolutely.
So. And it's really sad they're trying to move them again.
They're trying to move them and trying to move them all around, and they're not supporting them at all. They're fighting people that are trying to help homeless people. What does that say about our city's government? They're fighting against helping the homeless.
And they keep saying that homeless.
But yet they claim that there's so much help for homeless. Why are families being out on the streets and having to live at a warming shelter with their newborn?
Those are the voices of a homeless family that participated in today's Million Mask March in downtown Portland.
U.S. officials have refused a request for clemency for NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. The former contractor with the National Security Agency released thousands of classified documents that exposed a massive surveillance program by the U.S. government of U.S. and foreign citizens, including foreign leaders. For more, Pacifica Radio spoke with lawyer Jesselyn Radek, who has been in touch with Snowden, where he remains in asylum in Russia.
There's been considerable interest in his activities over the last few days. Word that he's taking a job at a Russian website, a picture purportedly showing him taking a tour of the Moscow River. Is it your sense that he has a fairly sort of normal lifestyle on Russian territory?
I don't think it's completely normal. I mean, all I can say is, you know, there are obviously security concerns, and that's primarily because of U.S. threats against him that continue in terms of people saying he's, you know, should be tried for treason. People, meaning members of Congress and heads of intelligence agencies, joking about putting him on the assassination kill list. And that kind of thing. So there is high security.
Now, there was also talk over the weekend about possible clemency and whether the United States would ever consider clemency, seemingly prompted by some sort of interaction Edward Snowden had with German officials. What, in your mind, is the case for either clemency or the legal charges against him to be dropped?
First of all, he did not request clemency anywhere in the letter. That is a really, I think, tortured interpretation that the New York Times put out, and that, of course, congressional apologists like Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers were able to use to get themselves on the Sunday morning talk shows here in the U.S. Obviously, he didn't request clemency because he has not been indicted, tried, or convicted. The word clemency appears nowhere in there, and he doesn't even address the letter to the U.S. It's to the German parliament. I think that was a way just to try to smear him again, to try to imply that he was guilty or that he's admitting guilt in some kind of way and asking for forgiveness. But in terms of dropping the case, as a general matter, I think the government should drop the case because obviously his disclosures have served a tremendous public interest. Obviously, they've evidenced conduct that's illegal, given that we have bills before Congress right now to try to remedy this conduct. And there's been an unprecedented war on whistleblowers using the Espionage Act, especially those in the national security and intelligence fields.
Now, you sort of just described Dianne Feinstein there, the senator from California, as a congressional apologist. She's generally not considered a sort of raging conservative, and she made the point over the weekend that Edward Snowden could have come to her committee as a whistleblower, provided the evidence that he had, and not, from her position, have placed American national security at risk. Why is she wrong?
She's wrong because I have taken numerous clients to her committee. Numerous clients of mine from the NSA have gone to the House and Senate intelligence committees and reported wrongdoing and not only received no remedy or redress, but then had the government turn around and prosecute them for espionage. So I find what she said completely disingenuous and actual entrapment to encourage people to come to her committee, given the way that it has behaved. In terms of damage to the U.S., the government, of course, says that over and over again in every whistleblower case, but in none of them, including Bradley Manning's, could they come up with a damage assessment or any real example of damage that's been caused.
That was Jesselyn Raddick, a lawyer with the Government Accountability Project, speaking about the current situation of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden.
A group of concerned parents and teachers organized a public meeting yesterday in St. Helens, Oregon, to challenge the local school board decision to allow teachers to carry concealed handguns in school. On October 23rd, the St. Helens School Board voted to reverse a ban on concealed weapons that was put in place earlier this year. Prior to the weapon ban in March, the St. Helens Girls Softball League auctioned off an AR-15 automatic rifle with 230-round magazines to raise money for the uniforms and equipment. But that ban on concealed weapons was brought up again by school board members in October, and the ban was lifted. Opponents were taken by surprise by the vote, saying the agenda was only listed on the school board website and no community input was solicited. In response, a group of teachers, parents, concerned citizens, and students have formed a group called the St. Helens Coalition for Safe Schools. They are organizing to bring a group of people to testify at November school board meeting, where the issue will be brought up again.
Kevin Hall, a Corvallis man who was openly carrying a gun and stopped by police, was paid $5,000 by the city of Corvallis to settle the lawsuit that Hall filed. In October of 2011, Kevin Hall was on his way to his mailbox carrying a holstered gun when he was stopped by a police officer who thought he looked suspicious. Hall, who has a concealed weapons permit, said he would only openly carry his weapon where it was legal, known as open carry, and is an advocate for open carry. He was also carrying a knife. The police officer who stopped him said that Hall looked suspicious because of what he was wearing and that he was openly carrying a gun and had a knife. He performed an exterior search of Hall and then let him go after checking to see if Hall had any warrants for his arrest. U.S. District Judge Michael McShane ruled that the officer was violating Hall's Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure. Hall first submitted a complaint to the police department but was unhappy with the results of that complaint, resulting in the lawsuit.
Today was election day in counties and states around the country, but turnouts were low, and the election lacked the media hype of a big presidential and congressional election years. Some of the most contested measures being decided today include the question of labeling genetically modified foods and seeds in Washington state, and a potential 25% tax on marijuana in Colorado, where it was legalized for recreational use last year. In Virginia, voters are selecting a new governor in a race that has been plagued with problems. Just days before today's election, the state of Virginia purged 38,000 voters from its voter rolls in a move that most analysts agreed would benefit the Republican candidate. The Democratic Party challenged the purge, but a judge ruled to allow the state to remove the voters from the list. But even with the removal of tens of thousands of voters from the rolls, the Democratic candidate, Terry McAuliffe, is leading in the exit polls and is expected to win the race. One of the elections that has drawn national attention is a city council election in the small town of Coralville, Iowa, which became a pet project for the conservative Koch brothers and their political action group, Americans for Prosperity. The conservative group poured tens of thousands of dollars into campaign ads on radio, newspaper, and television to try to impact the outcome of today's city council election in a town with a population of less than 20,000.
Today, voters in Washington state are casting ballots in a special election, which includes an initiative on the labeling of genetically modified foods. Washington State Initiative 522 would require that agricultural products, seeds, and seed stock containing GMOs be labeled when sold in stores. If passed, labels would begin appearing on food starting July 1, 2015. Today is the last day to vote on this ballot measure in Washington, and ballot boxes will remain open until 8 p.m. tonight.
After legalizing recreational marijuana in 2012, Colorado voters are deciding today on whether to tax the sale of marijuana in the state. If passed, today's initiative will tax marijuana producers at 15% and consumers at 10%. The money from the production tax will be used for school construction, and the sales tax revenue will pay for marijuana enforcement. Colorado state government officials say that the goal of the combined 25% tax is to generate enough revenue for enforcement. But they hope the price will still remain low enough to deter consumers from buying marijuana on the black market. Marijuana is still illegal under federal law, but federal agents announced last fall that they will not enforce the prohibition in Colorado and Washington as long as marijuana is not sold to minors or trafficked out to other states. In Colorado, a traditionally anti-state tax, any tax increase must get the voters' approval. The taxes are estimated to generate an estimated $67 million a year.
Food banks across the country are bracing for increased demand following federal cuts to food stamp programs. Starting Friday, benefits to 47 million recipients of food stamps were cut by 5%. Administrators of food banks in California and Florida have expressed concern that they may not have enough supplies to meet the increased need. Food banks served 37 million Americans in 2010, up from 25 million in 2006, according to the organization Feeding America. About 1 in 7 Americans currently receives food stamps.
In an update on the Reese's Fine Foods recall, the company has expanded their recall list for the third time since the first release of the recall in mid-October because of possible listeria contamination. Mark Reese, the company's president, released a statement on the company website that stated the Kansas plant linked to the contamination of the products was shut down for a deep cleaning. Extensive retraining of plant employees, contractors, and other personnel has begun. There are no known illnesses linked to the recall. Children and the frail and elderly people can have serious and possibly fatal infections caused by listeria and is a particular threat to pregnant women because it can cause stillbirths and miscarriages. The plant identifier code of the recalled items is 20. Consumers are advised to dispose of any recalled items or return them to the store for a full refund.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for a special interview with KBOO's Linda Olden Osterlund from A Deeper Look. She'll be speaking with an oceanologist about the impact of climate change on oceans and how that will impact us locally in the Pacific Northwest. Followed by Out Loud at 6, Out Loud tonight welcomes Max Voltage as he gives an update on an upcoming musical called Homomentum. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio welcomes Tiny Antoni Ramos of Poor News Network about Twitter's upcoming decision to invest in initial public offering practices. Also, a story on recent gentrification happening in San Francisco, and an interview with activist Rahman Jamal about Rap Freestyle Academy. Tomorrow's weather will be a drizzle of rain and a high of 58 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are: counts per minute in North Portland. In Beaverton, it's 28 counts per minute, with a high of 48. Damascus, Oregon, has a count of 32 counts per minute, and a high of 49. Powell Butte measures 25 counts per minute, with a high of 42. Seaside, Oregon, has 33 CPM, with a high of 50. Hanford, Washington, has 28 CPM, with a high of 40. And Sitka, Alaska, has a radiation count of 36 counts per minute, with spikes up to 60. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM, and more information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:30, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
On Wall Street, it's assumed that anything can be bought and sold, from fraudulent investment packages to Congress critters. It's no surprise, then, that the wizards of Goldman Sachs assumed that they could buy an image makeover, turning malicious, money-grubbing narcissists into huggable bankers who only want to serve humanity. Hence, Goldman recently surged into the glorious garden of corporate philanthropy, donating several million bucks to little people as a sign of the banker's generous character. But who do the Goldman Sachs think they're fooling? First, these banking barons are only putting a pittance into charity, doing a corporate imitation of the old billionaire robber baron John D. Rockefeller, who went around parsing out dimes to a few street urchins to buff up his sour public image. But worse, Goldman's sly executives are not even donating their own dimes. It's the shareholders' money that these bankers are doling out. Worse yet, it's also our money. By ours, I mean that Goldman's so-called gifts are deducted from the income taxes the bank owes, thus shorting America's public treasury of funds that we the people need for schools, roads, parks, clean water, and other essentials to advance our society's common good. Also, what is charitable about funneling $375,000 into one of Bill Clinton's show-and-tell PR events? This donation to one of Clinton's global initiative conferences allowed Goldman to emblazon its brand on a panel moderated by Chelsea Clinton. That's advertising, not charity. This is Jim Hightower saying, the more that Wall Street bankers try to purchase morality, the less they have. We don't want their false charity. We want honest accountability for their destructive greed, and we want a restructured, decentralized, and ethical banking system based on fairness and common decency.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The interim administrator at the Bonneville Power Administration, former Enron executive Elliot Mainzer, claims he's eager to get past the hiring scandal that saw two former officials get reassigned in July. An investigation and a pair of audits performed by the Department of Energy's Inspector General revealed massive problems within BPA's Human Resource Department. Massive problems within Bonneville's Human Resources Department revealed a lack of understanding of federal hiring procedures and an intentional manipulation of how job applicants were ranked that discriminated against veterans and other applicants. Mainzer said an investigation to reconstruct what became of nearly 600 applications between 2010 and 2013 is likely to result in a job offer to as many as a third of them. That investigation, however, isn't expected to conclude until next September.
A new study by the University of Washington suggests that coal trains may contribute to increased air pollution in the Pacific Northwest. The month-long study, headed by researcher Dan Jaffe, focused on locations along current coal train routes, including a site in the Columbia River Gorge. The study found a significant increase in large airborne particles after coal trains passed. BNSF Railway spokeswoman Courtney Wallace has questioned the study, which is currently undergoing peer review for online publication.
Shell Oil will begin drilling in environmentally sensitive Arctic waters soon in an effort to continue operations despite damage to some of its drilling equipment and increased scrutiny by the Department of Interior. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Shell Oil halted plans to drill in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas last year after damage occurred to drilling rigs and drilling platforms it planned to use. That, coupled with tougher rules by the Department of Interior on deepwater drilling, compelled the oil company to delay its 2013 and 2014 drilling seasons. But the company announced last Thursday that those plans have changed again.
My name is Michael Levine, and I'm Pacific Senior Counsel for Oceana, based in Juneau, Alaska.
Mr. Levine said both pieces of drilling equipment it planned to use were towed to Asia for repair. The one intended to be used in the Beaufort Sea was so badly damaged that the company decided not to drill there. But the equipment for the Chukchi Sea was determined to be not as badly damaged.
Last week, Shell announced that it was not going to proceed with proposals to drill in the Beaufort Sea and was considering a return to the Chukchi Sea. Now, to be clear, Shell's vessels are still disabled. The company does not have approvals. It must submit plans, and they must be vetted and reviewed by the Department of the Interior before any activity can occur in the Chukchi Sea.
Mr. Levine said that even though the company may resume drilling in one instead of both waterways, because of its environmental sensitivity, the possibility of serious environmental damage to the area is still no less of a risk.
The conditions are very harsh. There is no proven way to respond to an accident or a spill in either place, and no infrastructure to make such a response possible. If, in fact, Shell plans to return to the Chukchi Sea, we hope they learned from their mistakes in 2012, and we hope that the company and the government are both more responsible with the manner in which they think about whether these activities should be authorized and under what conditions.
Well, if I understand, I mean, these are Arctic sea conditions now for the winter time, aren't they? I mean, the seas are much rougher and it's dark most of the time. So if there was a spill or an accident, it would be a lot harder for them to clean up, wouldn't it?
That's correct. If Shell were allowed to drill for oil in the Chukchi Sea, those activities would happen during the summer when the ice cover has retreated. But if there were an accident, that oil would likely remain through the winter while sea ice returned, rendering what was already a nearly impossible task to respond entirely impossible.
The intention of Shell Oil to resume drilling in the Arctic comes not long after the Russian energy company Gazprom detained 20 Greenpeace activists for their interfering with their drilling operations in the Arctic. I asked Mr. Levine if we can expect to see more of this as climate change makes Arctic drilling more attractive not only to companies but to governments.
I think the answer to your question requires a look more broadly at what's happening to energy companies. They are being forced into more and more remote and difficult places in their search for oil. The Arctic is one of the most difficult places for companies to operate. And so, yes, we are likely to see these companies, unless they do more effective sorts of risk analysis, continuing to push for exploration and development in harsher places. And we hope that our federal government commits to better science and demonstrated response capacity so that it can actually make informed decisions about whether to allow these activities, and if so, under what conditions.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
And journalists, Greenpeace protesters, and journalists known as the Arctic 30 have been moved from a pretrial detention center in Murmansk to St. Petersburg. The group has been in custody since September 19th when they were arrested trying to board an oil rig in the Pechora Sea as part of a peaceful protest of a Russian energy company, Gazprom's plans to drill in the Arctic location. The Russian government is the majority shareholder of Gazprom. The Arctic 30 is comprised of Greenpeace activists, captain and crew members of the Arctic Sunrise, as well as independent journalists. They are being charged with piracy, and their applications for bail are being denied by Russian courts pending their November 24th trial. Russia added charges of hooliganism and vandalism, saying that they plan to drop the piracy charges. The Dutch government has petitioned the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea on behalf of the Arctic 30, arguing that Russia violated the law of the sea by boarding the Arctic Sunrise and detaining the Arctic 30. Russia refuses to accept arbitration and will not participate in proceedings in spite of its voluntary membership in the convention. Gazprom will move forward on plans to begin drilling in the Arctic in early 2014.
Brazil's Institutional Security Cabinet admits it spied on diplomats from the United States, Russia, and Iran a decade ago. The admission came after a leak published in the Brazilian newspaper Folha de São Paulo. In 2003 and 2004, the Brazilian intelligence agency spied on the U.S. in rooms rented by the U.S. embassy and in the capital city of Brasilia. Brazil explains its surveillance of the U.S. was in full compliance with its own counterintelligence legislation and was undertaken because it suspected the U.S. was using the rooms to conduct espionage of its own. During that same period of time, Brazilian intelligence agents followed Russian and Iranian diplomats on foot and by car. In response to the leak, the Brazilian government emphasizes that publishing a classified document is a crime in Brazil and intends to prosecute those responsible. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has been an outspoken critic of the United States' surveillance of her office and the state-owned oil company Petrobras.
And now, the latest news and development from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, November 5th, 2013. Palestinian political prisoners die in military detention while settlers take over farmlands in southern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Tuesday morning, Palestinian political detainee held by the Israeli army, Hassan Torabi, 22, died at Al-Afula Israeli Hospital after being denied essential medical treatment. He was recently moved to Al-Afula Hospital after a sharp deterioration in his health condition. Torabi is from Saora village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. He was taken prisoner by the Israeli military 10 months ago. 10 days ago, his condition severely deteriorated after his blood vessels ruptured. Palestinian human rights groups said that Torabi suffered from leukemia and was not provided with the urgent needed specialized treatment. Palestinian Minister for Detainees Isa Karaka said that the number of detainees who died in Israel prisons since the beginning of this year arrived to 4 now. In other news, a number of extremist Israeli settlers occupied a Palestinian home in the yard of the Ibrahimi Mosque in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources announced that the settlers broke into the home south of the mosque and that they brought with them digging equipment, beds and supplies, while heavily guarded by dozens of soldiers. The home is not rooftopped yet and is located near the area where Israeli soldiers have a permanent roadblock and electronic gate. Its location is of great significance as it overlooks the Ibrahimi Mosque, local sources said. Also in Hebron today, Israeli settlers started to open a road on Palestinian-owned land to the east of the city to connect their illegal settlement Givat Gal with other settlements. Residents said that bulldozers came from the nearby Kiryat Arba settlement and uprooted trees, making way for 8 meters wide street. The farmers who own the land have not received anything from the army to explain the attack by the settlers. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, November 5th, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Bassam Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rose Lynn Scott. Genevieve McDaniel, Robin Ryan, Sam Smith, and Don Merrill. The producer is Sequoyna Wright. Special thanks to Free Speech News. Our engineer is Sequoyna Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Lisa Loving welcomes members of Portland's diverse immigrant community and representatives from the Office of Equity and Human Rights of the City of Portland to talk about recognizing barriers to equal opportunity and access. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews Elliot Adams, former soldier and past president of National Veterans for Peace, about the Close Gitmo campaign and hunger strikes in solidarity with detainees. At 9:30, guest filmmaker Mark Kitchell talks about his film, A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, which is an exploration of the environmental movement, grassroots activism spanning 50 years from conservation to climate change. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thank you to KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. It's still not too late to pledge. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And now, stay tuned for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio. Good night. Good night, Emily.
Night, Nat.
How close were you to Mr.
Good evening. This is Linda Olson Osterlund for the KBOO Evening News Special Report. This evening, we're talking about the oceans off the coast of Oregon and Washington, the Pacific Northwest. And my guest is Andrew Thurber. He's an oceanographer with the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences down at OSU. Thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Oh,
no problem. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Andrew is, if you were listening last week, you know that Andrew is the author of a recent study. He's an oceanographer working in deep sea arena, and he is the co-author of a study, that recent study released just in October, that concluded that climate change will wreak havoc on oceans by 2100. The conclusions say that 98% of our oceans will, by 2100, will be impacted by multiple stressors. I understand that there are certain parts of the oceans that are going to be hit harder, and that the Pacific Northwest is one of those areas. Can you tell us a little bit of the background of why that would be so?
Well, the Pacific Northwest is one of those areas on the planet that has incredibly productive seas, largely driven by the upwelling, or essentially the sucking of deep water that's nutrient-rich up onto the shallower areas that allow the incredible photosynthetic production, or, you know, food for the base of the food chain that fuels the diverse fish we have off the coast here. But because there's a lot of nutrients there, those nutrients come from a lot of essentially organic material or food being broken down, and that lowers the pH of the water and also increases the CO2. Now, CO2 is one of the main things that our models looked at, or we were looking for, and pH stress is another one. Because they've also sucked down that, broken down all those nutrients, it also reduces the oxygen. So because of that, our coast is one of the prime areas on the planet, of which there's quite a few, where the strong upwelling also means that it's going to introduce our marine life to more intense, reduced oxygen, acidity, as well as changes in productivity.
And so those are pretty strong stressors. And I know that we've seen on the Oregon coast the oyster beds struggle with this. Can you talk a little bit about the effect of acidification? And the upwelling, because it's where so many fisheries are, we farm oysters over there because of the cold, nutrient-rich waters. Is that correct?
Well, the majority of the oysters that are farmed on the coast here are warm water species.
Oh, okay.
That are brought in, and they're farmed at slightly warmer temperatures, at least when they're young. When they get older, they get outplanted. So one of the nice things about the oyster fishery or program here is that the majority of the oysters that are harvested in this cold water can't actually reproduce, so we don't have an invasive species problem, as far as I know. But oysters are one of the organisms that have really been shown well that have to be very susceptible to acidification problems, because many different species tend to do one thing or another as we begin to understand how reduced pH is going to impact biology of species. However, oyster larvae, especially the one that's most commercially harvested here, is actually easier to stress at a very couple of key life stages. That means that it's one of the few industries that's directly impacted and acknowledged to be impacted by ocean acidification. So things are going to get more difficult for them. However, they're also one of the few industries that's really paying attention to this and trying to be proactive in it.
Now, I know that we've heard about a sardine collapse that's happening right now. And when I looked at Oregon fisheries and you know, what were major crops, so to speak, being brought in as commercial fishing in the 2011-2012, sardines was one of them. Clearly, that's not true this time around, and there have been new limits put on. Can we say that this is impacted, or an impact we might expect from low oxygen and from the problem, the stressors in areas like the Pacific Northwest, or is this some other form of anomaly? And what are the types of seafood, sea animals that we'll see most affected by these stressors?
So it's really hard to, one of the real challenges is it's very hard to pin one specific years or couple of years reduced fish stocks on something like long-term climate change, because there is an incredible amount of variability that happens on different timescales. So it really takes looking on over long-term timescales to figure out whether or not it is driven by something like the increased CO2 in the atmosphere, and whether that's oxygen or pH stress. Is something that just takes much more than just a few years of data to be able to pin it on that. It's possible, but it really can't speak to that anymore.
So what are the kinds of fish and the kinds of sea animals that we're going to see most impacted by the stressors off the Oregon coast? I mean, obviously, we start to think about salmon. There's many stressors on them that aren't even related to the coast, like dams. But tell me more about that, what we should be expecting to see, the kinds of problems as we're going forward.
Well, one of the biggest problems is going to be the change in the base of the food web. Euphausids, which are krill, are one of the staples of the food web in the pelagic realm, or the kind of the sea surface, especially the world over. And they're also one of the groups that's going to be most impacted. That has huge ramifications throughout the food web, including cetaceans or whales are going to be impacted as a result of that. Deeper species and other incredibly profitable species like squid, they were another one of the groups that was going to be most impacted by this concomitant or mixture of multiple stressors.
What about things like the pink shrimp that we see as a commercial product coming from off our coast?
So we really looked at kind of broad scale on a global pattern, mm-hmm. which is one of the unique things of the study. And so we can't say necessarily exactly how any one of them is going to be impacted, such as the pink shrimp. However, what's really important, because it's a type, and also, you know, when you look at things with a huge brush, which we did in this case, you see the general patterns, whereas when you look at a very fine brush for a very specific species or group, finer than what we looked at here, it really then falls down onto the physiology of that particular species and whether or not it's going to be able to handle the stressors. And one of the important things from this study is you can't just look at, for example, a slight increase in temperature and how that's going to impact a given species. But you really need to look at multiple stressors. And often, prior to this, people look at one, at most two stressors on how it might impact the physiology of a particular species. But this says you need to not look at one or two. You really need to start looking at three or four if you want to accurately get an idea of how the marine environment is going to be impacted in the future.
I think that's incredibly important that this study had that reach and looked at the multiple stressors. I know in the past when I've wanted to talk to people about what are the perils that our oceans are facing, it's one expert on one area of expertise, another expert on another area of expertise, which of course we need you scientists to focus in deeply into the areas you do. That's how we learn from you. But it makes it a little bit harder to get an overall picture. It sounds like this study actually came out of groups of scientists talking to each other and saying, we really need to be able to look at all of these stressors. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was exactly it. The need to look at multiple stressors and even a subset of the stressors that are going to be impacting the environment. Because in addition to all of the ones we studied, there's still pollution, sea level rise, a variety of different land use issues that impact the marine environment. Those were all going along over top of these four stressors that we looked at.
And I know that there are some people concerned about radiation, the ongoing radiation leaks that are going on from Fukushima, and if those are going to be having an impact off our coast, and do we know what those are at all? Do you have anything you can say about that, or is that just another stressor you know is out there?
I think this is not my area of expertise. My understanding from people is that by the time most of that radiation gets to our coast, it's going to be not really a main concern. Its main concern is going to be around the reactor itself. It gets quite spread out as it travels around the ocean.
Yes, and it depends on when it stops, doesn't it? In part, when the leaking stops, when the
most important thing is to stop the leak as soon as possible. Yes,
all right,
definitely.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Andrew Thurber, oceanographer with Oregon State University's College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Science. I should say that to be able to locate his report, which is titled "Study Concludes Climate Change Will Wreak Havoc on Oceans by 2100," you can go to CEOAS.OregonState.edu and look up the report. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about our ocean's future.
Thank you for having me. And I'd also like to add that this study, the original work, is free to download. It's not behind a paywall, so people can go read it themselves. Thanks again for having me on.
That's great information. Thank you, Andrew.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall. 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Women's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the...
This KBOO program is made possible...
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO. My name is Carla, and tonight we're going to be welcoming Max Voltage back to the show. And Max has been on the show a couple of times because they are a local event producer, and tonight